From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the songs of ecstasy and devotion composed by the 17th century Italian nun Lucrezia Vezzana. Her complete collection of published songs are recorded for the first time on a new CD. We'll talk with one of the singers, Deborah Roberts, of the early music ensemble Tala Scholars and the group Musica Secreta. And we'll talk with the historian who rediscovered Vezzana's work and has written a book about the music and culture in her convent. It's a fascinating chapter in the history of music and religion. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews the new book by New York Times reporter Lisa Belkin about the racial tensions that followed the integration of public housing in Yonkers, New York. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Since this is the time of Passover and Easter, we're devoting today's show to a fascinating story about religion and music. A new CD features the songs of Ecstasy and Devotion, composed by the Italian nun Lucrezia Vizzana. The songs were first published in 1623 and are recorded in their entirety for the first time. Vizzana lived in a convent in Bologna from the age of 8 in 1598 to her death in 1662. The church had tightened its controls on the lives of nuns, making it difficult for nuns to study music. Vizzana was the only nun in Bologna to have her compositions published. Later we'll talk with one of the singers on the new CD. First we'll hear from Craig Munson, the historian who rediscovered Vizzana's music. He's the author of Disembodied Voices, about the music and culture in Vizzana's convent, and he's a professor of music at Washington University in St. Louis. Let's start with the opening track of the new CD, Lucrezia Vizzana. Set the stage for us a little bit. Lucrezia Vizzana was a nun in a convent. What was the role of music in the convent that she lived in the 17th century?
The official role of music was to adorn the services. For the nuns, their primary job in life was effectively to sing the services, what they called the Opus Dei. During the course of the day, they would sing 6 or 8 services spread out every 2 hours. The thing is, she goes one step further and provides rather more elaborate music that was designed not simply to adorn the service, but also to highlight the musical capabilities of the nuns within this convent, which in the city of Bologna was particularly known for its musically talented women.
Lucrezia Vizzana lived her life in a convent. Do you think that she could have had any kind of musical life outside of the convent? Were women in Italy during her lifetime allowed to perform or publish their music?
Well, there were possibilities, but it was an interesting sort of situation where public performance was frowned upon, particularly for women of the upper classes. To perform on the stage was, I suppose one could say, 1 or 2 steps away from prostitution in a way, that sort of public display. So to have a respectable career as a woman musician, the convent was the primary open venue for composers, women composers.
One of the really astounding things about this period, I think you say in 1631, 13.8% of the female population in Bologna lived in convents, and the percentage was even higher in the upper classes. That's really an extraordinarily high number.
Right. I mean, the way things seemed to work, you didn't want to squander the family patrimony by providing large dowries for a number of daughters. So the customary thing was often to marry one daughter off with a decent-sized dowry and make a useful family connection, but the others often were all sent to convents. And it's quite usual to find of 6 daughters, 5 will be sprinkled about amongst the convents in a city. This was so common that the church hierarchy had a decree that said that no more than 2 daughters from one family could be put in a single convent, lest that family create a power block within the institution.
So obviously these aren't women who were there because they felt called. I'm sure some of them felt called, but I'm sure a lot of them didn't, but they were stuck there and had no choice.
Well, basically, yeah. Some of them did have religious vocations, but for many of them, this might not have been the option they would have chosen. But on the other hand, they often didn't know other options. Lucrezia Vizzana, for example, went to the convent when she was 8 years old, before she really had experienced much in the world. Also, there were three of her aunts already in the convent who presumably took her in, brought her up, doted upon her. So in fact, she might have done better in the convent than she would have done had she been in the outside world.
Why was Vitzana sent to a convent at the age of 8 back in 1598?
Well, her mother had died shortly before, and often it was not considered safe for young women to remain unchaperoned in the house with their father and their brothers. It happens that her father remarried shortly afterwards, and that may have also had an effect.
Now, this was a convent that was known for its music. Was there music training that she was exposed to when she got to the nunnery, to the convent?
Well, it happens that one of her mother's three sisters, who were all nuns at Santa Cristina, was the convent organist, Camilla Bombacci. So she probably received her initial instruction from her aunt. Interestingly enough, because of her talents, however, the nuns secretly arranged for music lessons with the organist of San Petronio, Ottavio Vernizzi. And of course, this flew in the face of the restrictions imposed by the church hierarchy. Nevertheless, the nuns went ahead and did it. Obviously, once the church hierarchy found out about this during the investigation of 1623, they promptly put a stop to it.
Was the problem that this instructor was a man? This organist
was
a man?
Oh, yes, uh-huh. Yes.
What were the church's regulations about music? What could be sung? When it could be sung?
Well, for nuns, it was appropriate for them to sing Gregorian chant, and if the church authorities had their way, that was all they would sing. But of course, the nuns tended to aspire to more elaborate music, to polyphony. The regulations tend to vary from city to city. In Bologna, the bishop said that they could sing with one solo voice to the organ, and they were supposed to be limited to that combination.
Was harmony considered dangerous?
Well, I think it was the idea that one voice and organ provided a very austere medium. And again, the bishop was probably thinking a Gregorian chant supported by the organ in harmony. If you have four voices, if you have strings and winds, it becomes much more of a show, much more alluring to the outside population and so forth.
Let's pause here and listen to some of the music composed by Lucrezia Vitzana. I'd like you to choose something from the new CD of her music and tell us why you've chosen this.
Well, it might be interesting to listen to O Invictissima Christi Martyr, partly because this is a motet that's addressed to Saint Christina, the patron saint of the convent. So presumably this motet would have been heard every year on the matronal festival of the convent, which was the major musical event of the year. It's also interesting because it plays upon some of the musical paradigms that are associated with convents. One of the aspects one often finds emphasized is the idea of echo. And here, this is a piece for two sopranos who presumably would have been performing from behind grilled windows up near the vaults of the church where they were invisible and these voices were simply emanating from behind the walls. And Vitzana plays on the idea of echo. The motet begins with one voice singing alone, and then at a certain point, the second voice creeps in, echoing the first voice, and it's when they first begin to call upon the saint. And for a moment, you're not sure whether this is still one voice or two. The other thing that's interesting is the emphasis on music. The motet ends, "That we may sing," at which point the two solo voices take off with elaborate vocal pyrotechnics, displaying their ability to do elaborate runs and ornaments and so forth. So it very self-consciously points out the sort of musical talents for which the convent and indeed the composer were probably known.
Okay, this is the music of Lucrezia Vitzana, performed by a group called Musica Secreta.
Christina.
Music from the CD Lucrezia Vezzana, Songs of Ecstasy and Devotion from a 17th century Italian convent, performed by Musica Secreta. And my guest is Craig Monson, who has written a book called Disembodied Voices, Music and Culture in an Early Modern Italian Convent. He writes about Lucrezia Vezzana in this book. I was really struck by the image before we heard this track that you described to us of people from outside the convent hearing these beautiful voices hidden within the walls of the convent. Did the nuns actually emerge in any way and perform in such a way so that outsiders could see and hear them?
Well, they could be heard, but to see them was one of the strongest prohibitions. In Bologna, for example, in a convent such as Santa Cristina, there were hardly any openings in the walls where the public might catch a glimpse of the nuns. The only spot where they were regularly visible was in the so-called parlatorios, or parlors, where their families could come visit them. Those were rather like the visiting rooms in a modern prison. There was a room on each side of a wall that had barred windows joining the two rooms, and they could sit on each side and converse. In the chapel itself, however, they were strictly separated. A convent church, in fact, involves an outer church, which is open to the public, and an inner church, which is the area to which the nuns are confined. Those two chapels are joined usually by a wall behind the high altar, and that wall is pierced only by a window above the altar, high enough so that the public in the outer church can't view the nuns, but low enough that when the priest celebrating Mass in the outer church elevates the host during the Mass, the host will become visible to the nuns in their inner chapel. And that one window was the main link between the two. Now, in chapels such as the chapel at Santa Cristina, where music was important, there would also be grilled windows in the organ lofts or the choir lofts where the nuns would be singing so that the sound would carry into the outer chapel. But the important thing was that the nuns never be visible. So the sound simply seems to come out of nowhere from up in the vaults of the church. And often one hears talk of voices as if of angels, angelic voices, celestial sirens, and that sort of general vocabulary.
My guest is music historian Craig Monson. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Craig Monson, the author of Disembodied Voices, about the 17th century nun and composer Lucrezia Vezzana and the music in her convent. Lucrezia Vezzana obviously had this gift for writing music. I'm wondering if you know if she was frustrated by the fact that she was confined behind the walls of the convent. And again, it's not like she had a calling for this. She was placed there as an 8-year-old. She never had a choice.
Well, of course, it's very hard to know because we have very few of her own words, and the words we have, she obviously very carefully considered because they are always directed towards church authorities, and most of them actually come out of the context when the convent was investigated for supposed infractions. So she doesn't tell us much. But one imagines that since she went there so young, it was basically the only life she knew, and she was treated as a special person because of her talents. One thing that is interesting, of course, is that after the publication of this collection in 1623, we hear no more of her as a composer. For the last 40 years of her life, she published nothing else, and it's not clear if she, in fact, composed further.
Now, there were complaints about her music, weren't there?
Well, there were complaints about music making in the convent. Mm-hmm. She herself seems to have been rather discreet. I mean, she's very circumspect about what she actually says to church authorities. it happens that her collection appeared at exactly the time when the church authorities came to the convent and undertook a major investigation of the nuns, because one nun had written to Rome secretly claiming that the convent was a hotbed of immorality and that the nuns were ignoring their sacred vows and so forth. And therefore, the bishop sent a commission to the convent to interview every nun from the oldest to the youngest in the manner of an inquisition, as it were. And what had started the investigation, in fact, was the suggestion by the disgruntled nun that it had all started because of music.
And music was, what, this doorway into more secular and carnal feeling?
Presumably. As it happens, it would, in this case, it had a lot to do with rivalry between two other talented musical nuns who both wanted to have control of the chapel choir. And essentially a power play was worked out, and the nun who lost this little struggle was the one who then wrote to Rome.
Now, Lucrezia Vezzana is said to have gone mad. What do you know about that?
Well, she was weak throughout her life, as early as the 1620s, when the convent was investigated by the church hierarchy. She admitted that she didn't get up for early morning prayers because she was unwell. In the convent necrology, it also points out that she was increasingly afflicted with severe illness, which, quote, she bore with virile fortitude, I think they say. It's the father confessor that points out that because of this investigation and the really extraordinary battles that took place as a result of it, her weak constitution couldn't stand up to the stress, and eventually she was driven mad by all this political unrest within the convent walls, so that whenever she heard the church bells ring, she would flail out madly, I think he says.
Tell us more about what the investigation was about.
Well, this one nun had written to Rome suggesting that the convent had become a place of laxity and immorality. The local bishop used this as an excuse to try to wrest control of the convent away from the Camaldolese order to which they were subject, so that he wanted the convent to be under his control. Of course, the nuns and their superiors resisted this power of play, and they resisted it extraordinarily strongly, to the extent that they took vows not to submit to the bishop. They chased away his emissaries. At one point, he sent the police to wall up any windows and doorways to the convent to cut them off effectively from the outside world. The nuns knocked down the wall that the police had put up overnight, and then when the police came back the next day, the nuns went up on the roof and pelted them with bricks and stones, while Lucrezia Vezzana's sister went up to a high window and exhorted the crowd to come to the aid of the convent. So it's a sort of extraordinary state of play that is unlike anything one associates with nuns.
Do you love the music?
I love the music a lot. I don't think it's great music. I tend to react to music of this period by asking myself, well, does this merit a second hearing or a third hearing? And I think this music is convincing in its own terms and bears repeated hearings. Not all the music of this period does. Other music, the music of Claudio Monteverdi, for example, is obviously far greater. But I think Lucrezia Vezzana's music is convincing on its own terms and does the job for which she created it, i.e. to adorn the services of the house and also to call attention to the nuns within the walls. I think it does that job quite convincingly.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, it's been my pleasure, and I appreciate your interest.
Craig Monson is the author of Disembodied Voices, about Lucrezia Vezzana and her convent. He's a professor of music at Washington University in St. Louis. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN, by Antioch University, a place for writers, on the web at www.antioch.edu, or 937-767-6494, and by Random House, publishers of Confucius Lives Next Door, What Living in the East Teaches Us About Living in the West, by T.R. Reid. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
We're listening to Deborah Roberts singing the music of the 17th century Italian nun Lucrezia Visana. Coming up, we talk to Roberts about reviving music that had been hidden behind convent walls. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews a new book about the integration of public housing in Yonkers, New York. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the first half of our show, we discussed the life and music of the 17th century Italian nun Lucrezia Vizzana. My guest, Deborah Roberts, is a member of Musica Secreta, the vocal group which revives Vizzana's work on a new CD. Musica Secreta specializes in early music that was originally performed by women. Roberts is also a longtime member of the internationally renowned early music group, the Tala Scholars. The new CD, Lucrezia Vizzana, is the first complete recording of Vizzana's compositions, which were first published in 1623. Deborah Roberts, welcome to Fresh Air.
Hello.
I'd like you to choose a selection from your new CD and tell us about it and why you've chosen it.
Right, well, firstly, Protector Noster, which is the one piece that's actually in four parts, using all the four singers. It's probably not the very greatest piece of music. I find it quite fascinating, though, that this is a piece of music written for a convent, but originally scored for soprano, alto, tenor and bass. Now, we're pretty sure that the nuns couldn't have sung as low as that. So what we've done is put it up a fifth in pitch, which makes the soprano part fairly high, but actually does also mean that the bass part is still quite low, though it can just about be sung by a woman's voice. I think it gives the full breadth of what a female vocal ensemble can actually achieve. And most importantly, this is something which goes beyond just this disc and this particular nun composer. It gives a little insight to the range of music that could have been performed in convents in the 16th and 17th centuries.
Why do you think that Vizzana was writing for a bass voice if she was only writing for women in the convent?
Because I think, very pragmatically, she was aware that this was, after all, music that was published and therefore could be sold and bought. And I think that all nun composers wrote music using all four voices because they knew then that it could be used in other places than just convents. And they had a passion to have their voices heard. Not just their physical voices, but their metaphorical voices through their music would be heard and performed elsewhere.
This is the group Musica Secreta, featuring my guest Deborah Roberts.
Thank you.
That's Musica Secreta, performing music by the 17th century nun Lucrezia Vizzana. My guest is Deborah Roberts of the ensemble. When you found out about Lucrezia Vizzana's music, why did you want to perform it?
Because I thought it was extraordinarily beautiful and unusual.
What's unusual about it?
She's obviously not a first-rate professional composer. She's somebody who would have picked up an education in any way that she possibly could. And yet there's such deep integrity in the music. There's something so personal about it that the appeal, I think, is enormous. And I've been very pleased at how many people agree with me, to be honest.
Now, how does this compare to the rest of your repertoire in early music?
Well, obviously, the sort of music I sing quite a lot of the time is 16th century mixed voice polyphony, because I've, for 20 years, been a member of the Talis Scholars. But in terms of the 17th century music I sing, it's very much consistent with it. I actually do work quite a lot with nuns' music and with 17th century female composers such as Barbara Strozzi. I've had an interest in this for a good many years.
Is there much music composed by women of this period where the women weren't nuns?
Not a lot. In fact, most of them were nuns that actually had the time to compose, because if you think about it, well, for a start, quite a large number of women were nuns, far, far more than we would perhaps realise. If a woman got married, she usually gave up her music as soon as she was married, whether she was a singer or composer. She would be busy having babies and probably die quite early. Barbara Strozzi, who is the most successful and famous woman composer of the 17th century, I think owed her position to the fact that she never did marry. She was a professional, fully professional composer, supported herself entirely by the publications of her works.
And for anyone else who wanted to publish, better to be a nun.
Well, yes, quite likely. I think it was absolutely unheard of for a married woman to continue her music.
Mm-hmm. Now, the music that you're singing that was composed by the 17th century nun, Lucrezia Vizzana, was written for women's voices. Is it hard to find music of the period that is written for women?
Well, I used to think so, but now I'm realising that so much of music we've traditionally thought was written for either men's voices or mixed men's and boys' voices was probably performed by nuns anyway. They made their own arrangements. And I've started to do that, to take well-known music by Palestrina, Lazarus, Victoria, and arrange it the way that the nuns did. So in a way, it's turned the whole argument around on itself.
Let me ask you to choose a selection from your new CD that illustrates what you find particularly beautiful about women's voices harmonizing together.
Well, the very first one, as you just played, Protecto Noster. There you've got the very high soprano line, which has to be fairly clear and straight. Then you've got, that would have been the original soprano line. As I said, we've put it up a fifth, so it's actually quite high now. Then the original alto line becomes another lower soprano line. You've got a mezzo-soprano singing the tenor line, and you've got a really deep alto singing the bass. That's fairly widely spread, and yet I think it fuses together really beautifully. Now, on the other hand, the sound we more associate as being luscious female voices blending together is movement in thirds with parts that are quite close together, which you get in all the other duets. So you've got both types here in this collection.
Do you want to choose a duet for us to listen to?
Well, I was just thinking that one of the duets for two sopranos, Amor Christum, which is effectively a love song to Christ.
Anything else you want to say about it or about the harmonies?
Well, I think the text is really quite extraordinary. I love Christ, whose bedchamber I shall enter. I mean, it's really quite graphically almost like a wedding song. Enter as and leave as a virgin, however. But I think what I find fascinating about these particular pieces is that they're using all the kind of tricks of the trade that would have been used by composers for secular love songs, and here they are turned around into sacred pieces.
Are you talking about lyrically or musically?
Both.
Uh-huh. Both. Okay. Well, let's listen to it. And this is from the new CD of music of the 17th century nun, Lucrezia Visana, performed for us by Musica Secreta, featuring my guest, Deborah Roberts. Music from the new CD of compositions by the 17th century nun Lucrezia Visana, performed by Musica Secreta, featuring my guest, soprano Deborah Roberts. Deborah, which soprano were you on that recording?
Well, I'm one of them, yes, and Tessa Bonner the other. It's hard to say which one because the parts, they
alternate,
swap around.
Right.
Yes. They're both equal in height and they cross over quite a lot. Giving that lovely sort of sound of thirds moving in parallel thirds together.
Let's take a break here and then we'll talk more with Deborah Roberts. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Deborah Roberts. Her vocal group, Musica Secreta, performs on the new CD, Lucrezia Visana, Songs of Ecstasy and Devotion from a 17th century Italian convent. Now, the lyrics in the songs that you're singing by Lucrezia Visana are all very religious lyrics, and I'm wondering if you think about that as you're singing it, if you think of yourself as singing this in a secular way or in a religious way.
I myself am not religious. Not in a traditionally Catholic or Christian way necessarily. However, I would say that I have absolutely no problem at all entering in to the spirit in which I feel Visana wrote these pieces. I hope that doesn't sound contradictory. I can understand spirituality very, very deeply, and it's music that moves me because I can feel something of what she felt, even though I might feel it for slightly different things. My life has been very different to hers. It still speaks to me, however.
Now tell me why you're drawn to this period, to music of the 16th and 17th centuries.
I think I heard my first piece of 16th century music when I was about 13, and I only heard about 3 bars of it and thought, that's for me. I can't say why, it just appealed immediately. It doesn't mean I don't love a lot of later romantic and early 20th century, even contemporary music, but that's the music that I just feel so drawn to it. I feel I can understand it, get into it.
I'd say that the music we've been listening to has almost like an austere beauty to it.
Yes, I would say it's more... I don't even like the word controlled. It's very hard to find the right word to describe it. There's something... it's not extravagant in one sense, and yet it can be. It can be very extravagant in what it's portraying, but it doesn't always have to do so with a great big noise.
Is there a certain performance style of the period that you keep in mind when you perform this music?
Well, I think one does, as a musician, for any period of music, you do consider what the performance practice of that time would have been. You also consider what the conditions might have been like. But on the other hand, and at the same time, I very firmly believe that we're now talking to modern audiences, so I'm not interested in trying to make it sound necessarily as it would have done then, even if that were possible.
Do you find this music particularly difficult to sing, the music of Vizzana?
No, not really, no. It's actually quite pleasantly easy to sing, in a sense. It's not over-demanding technically. What I think the challenge is to get inside those texts and get inside the what she was actually trying to express. But that is so much the job of the singer of 17th century music, because the texts were so important then.
Well, how do you try to do that?
Well, I always start a piece by looking at the text first, make sure I understand absolutely every word of it. Before I sing a note of it, I will have spoken the text through several times. I will have actually performed the text. Then I start to put the notes to it and see how they work together.
Now, I want to get back to the idea of music written for women from this period. As a singer of early music, I think some of the women's parts that you sing are parts that were actually written for boys or for castrati.
Oh, indeed, yes. Though as I'm beginning to realise, they may well have also been sung by women, mm-hmm. hidden away in their convents. But yes, I mean, I must admit, for so many years, one of the things that used to madden me about reviews of Talis Scholars concerts would be when either the reviewers said, gosh, they're so good, they sound almost as good as boys, or why doesn't the Talis Scholars use boys instead? And you think, yes, you could imagine taking a troupe of boys on a 2 or 3 week tour of the States with flights every day and a concert every night. I don't think that would work. No,
No one suggested castrati, did they?
Well, I don't think we tend to go in for that anymore. I think what has happened too is that there's been a rise in falsetto singing. And that's another, I think, fallacy that there was so much falsetto singing in the past. I don't think there was as much as we have been led to believe. Whatever, that's slightly irrelevant, though, I think. Mm-hmm. But as for us singing parts that were written for boys' voices, yes, I think that's certainly true. It's very nice to get to sing music that was definitely written for women to sing.
What's the difference to you between singing a part that was written for a woman and singing a part that was written for a boy?
I don't approach it any differently. I use the same basic technique, which is, strictly speaking, a modern vocal technique, to sing it. It's just that very often, particularly with a really fine composer like Barbara Strozzi, the music just feels great on the voice. The phrases are the right kind of length. In fact, actually, it's more interesting to compare music written for sopranos with that written for castrati, because we sing with Musica Sacra, we do quite a lot of carissimi, a Roman composer who was writing mostly for castrati. The phrases are always just that little bit too long. And from what we know of the castrati, they did have these enormously developed barrel chests, and they could go on forever without breathing. A little bit like seals, really. I think they looked like them, too.
So it was. It requires a much more kind of athletic approach to breathing?
I think so, yes.
Has recording music by nuns made you think a lot about what your life would have been like as a female singer if you'd lived in a much earlier century?
Oh, yes. Well, of course. It has made me wonder quite a lot. In fact, it's made me very privileged, because I can be sitting there working on the editions for the music, and then I can just walk outside into the sunshine of my garden, look at the South Downs opposite me, go and stroke the cat, and come back in and make a cup of coffee. It's lovely.
Be in the world.
Be in the world with my nice Italian man. Yes.
And you can perform and you can be seen, which of course Lucrezia Vizzana could not.
That's right. They could perform, but they weren't supposed to be seen. I think quite a few people did get sneak views every now and then, but mostly they were heard. I've often thought just what effect those unseen voices must have been on people hearing them, given that nowadays it's a bit lost on us because we're so used to recordings, so that we often do hear music without seeing people. We don't think anything about hearing music coming out of a loudspeaker, but it must have been quite extraordinary in the 17th century to sit in one of these outer churches and just hear these voices drifting through bars and windows high up in the church.
Do you think it would have added a lot of mystery?
Oh, yes. These were angels singing from heaven, weren't they? Singing for the souls of the people. This just was their job, to pray and sing for everybody else. They were the sacrificial victims in many ways, but quite a few of them. They made a life for themselves. It might have, in some cases, been a better life than they might have got outside.
Well, Deborah Roberts, thank you for reviving this music. It's been a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you very much.
Deborah Roberts sings with the Talis Scholars and with Musica Secreta. Musica Secreta's new CD is called Lucrezia Vizzana, Songs of Ecstasy and Devotion from a 17th century Italian convent. Coming up, a new book about the integration of public housing. This is Fresh Air. In her new book, Show Me a Hero, New York Times Magazine contributing writer Lisa Belkin tells a story that hit close to her Westchester home, what happened when the city of Yonkers was ordered to comply with a desegregation ruling in the late 1980s. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
Lisa Belkin's compelling new book, Show Me a Hero, owes a lot to J. Anthony Lucas's reportorial masterpiece, Common Ground. In fact, you might think of Show Me a Hero as Common Ground light. For one thing, Belkin's book is much shorter, and instead of Boston, her story takes place in the much smaller city of Yonkers, New York. Instead of the citywide school desegregation battles that ripped Boston apart in the 1970s, Belkin's subject is a controversial plan that Yonkers adopted in the late 80s for scattered site public housing. small clusters of townhouses situated in white, middle-class neighborhoods that would be overwhelmingly inhabited by Black single mothers and their children. But if Belkin's story is slighter than Lucas's, its implications are just as weighty. For cities, whatever their size, are the places where American democracy is really put to the test. Lucas's Boston failed that test. A decade or so later, Belkin's Yonkers earned itself, maybe a C. I guess you can regard that either as progress or grade inflation. Show Me a Hero begins on the night in 1992 that Belkin, a first-time homeowner, was lured by a mixture of curiosity and anxiety to a public housing lottery. The room she walked into that night was crammed with minority women breathlessly waiting to see if their assigned numbers would be plucked out of a bingo drum. If so, they and their children would be plucked out of dangerous high-rise public housing and deposited in clusters of new townhouses some 10 minutes away from Belkin's own neighborhood. The townhouse concept was the brainchild of an architectural consultant named Oscar Newman, who, like some latter-day William Morris, argued that housing designated for the poor should give them a sense of ownership and should not be stigmatized by ugliness. Newman alternately sounds like a crackpot or a visionary, and maybe because, as Belkin claims, Yonkers itself is such a scruffy, eccentric, and polarized city, her story is populated with lots of other outsized characters. There's Nick Wasisco, who was only 28 when he was elected mayor of Yonkers in 1987. Wasisco ran in opposition to the scattered site public housing idea, but when he and the city caved to federal pressure, his angry constituents mailed him bullets. Wasisco's career and ego crumbled. He committed suicide in 1993. Then there's the more inspiring story of Mary Dorman, a white working-class woman who became politicized by protesting the townhouses and then ended up working for the rights of their residents. And there's Alma Feebles, a Dominican single mother who was so excited by the prospect of living in a townhouse that she began buying new kitchen gadgets on time years before the move. When Alma finally did settle in, she reacted to the news that more townhouses were about to be built by declaring, with totally unconscious irony, "They should build more, but I hope not right near here. This is such a quiet, pretty block." I didn't like hearing Alma utter that "not in my backyard" declaration, nor did I like hearing the uncomfortable questions and sentiments that Show Me a Hero provoked in my own white middle-class mind. Like, why, when judges issue desegregation rulings, do they never target their own upper-middle-class neighborhoods? Do people in public housing really deserve such amenities as front lawns and their own washer-dryers? Why didn't the public townhouse residents here seem more grateful? Maybe the question we all should be asking, that Show Me a Hero briefly raises, is why aren't there more jobs around that pay a decent enough wage to move people out of dependency on public housing in the first place? Show Me a Hero is an absorbing but not an uplifting book. Despite its title, heroes and heroic solutions were as hard to find in recent years in Yonkers as they were 20 years ago in Boston.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Show Me a Hero by Lisa Belkin. Fresh Air's senior producer today was Roberta Shirok. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Joan Tui-Westman, Naomi Person, and Kathy Wolf, with Anne-Marie Baldonado and Tracy Tannenbaum. Research assistance from Sam Adams. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Serta, maker of the Serta Perfect Sleeper mattress, helping generations of Americans to sleep since 1931. and from Little Brown and Company, publishers of All Too Human, A Political Education by George Stephanopoulos, in bookstores. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, as Jews celebrate Passover and Christians observe Good Friday, we hear from Houston Smith, the author of The World's Religions. It's been a staple of college courses for over 30 years. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.